Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Katie Schweitzer.
Okay, Katie. Welcome back to the Speaking of Reliability. What's new in your world? We only talked a few minutes ago in our recording session, but I didn't ask you that in the first one.
What's new in my world? Well, I recently took a new position and moved to West Virginia.
That's new. Yeah. Did you get there in time for the cold snap this winter?
I did. I've actually been there about 9 months because I, but it doesn't feel that long because I had a baby in August.
Oh, okay.
And that's consumed quite a bit of time, Fred. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you understand.
Yeah, certainly do. We had two neighbors, and both of which we know fairly well, are younger couples, and they had they met at a party we have in the community. We have a community park a couple blocks away, and we're running events there this last summer, looking forward to doing it again. And these two couples showed up, and they recognized each other as both being very pregnant, and they were due within a week of each other. So now we have two. I think one's 3 months, one's four, 3 months and a week, and both doing fine and all healthy. But yeah, it's my wife and I are like, yeah, we remember those days. And we brought dinner over for him a couple times and offered to help and wherever we can.
I bet you don't miss it though.
No. We hear the crying in the distance going, good. Not ours. Just doesn't have the same.
You're lucky you don't hear the crying in the distance right in my house right now, but both of the babies are thankfully asleep while we're recording this.
Oh, that's good. Right. But, you know, was this your first reliability gig or not?
No, I've basically been in reliability since I was a co-op in college.
Oh, wow. You were born to be a reliability engineer. That's rare.
I think it was meant to be, Fred. I really do.
All right. Well, I want to mention that I think it was our 200th episode. I went around the table and asked all of the co-hosts, you know, what got them into, at that point, it was what got them into consulting. It ended up being reliability for everybody. So why don't we take a quick break, and then I'll ask you the same question. What got you into reliability? What was, you know, how did you get started? But let's pause for a moment.
Hi, it's Fred here. Are you looking for just the right book, conference, degree program, journal, or other reliability-related resource? There's a lot out there, and unless you know where to look, and you'll find a limited set of options. Ascendo Reliability has a top 10 resources listing for 10 different categories of professional development. Find out what is available today at ascendoreliability.com/go/resources.
All right. Well, I gave you a few seconds there to think about it, and I hopefully you're a religious follower of our and caught up with all of our 300 episodes. It's hard to believe that there's that many episodes on it. But I think it was the 200th episode. It's what got you started? What got you into consulting? And everybody that answered it from they were doing reliability engineering work. So I think the fair question is, as a college intern or co-op, I think you mentioned, what is a co-op versus an intern? And how would you, how do you get started there?
It's your level of dedication, Fred. The intern is just in the summer and a co-op is going to be a semester in a summer.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I did 5 internships and co-ops before I graduated college because I hated college with a passion. I did not enjoy academics, but I loved working. And so I did as many internships and co-ops as I could get away with.
Okay.
To keep myself sane.
Well, I mean, these were with different factories or different settings. Because if I remember right, you're in plant maintenance, plan in supporting factories, essentially, as a reliability engineer.
So I did several co-ops and internships that weren't so much factories. But the big one that really got me my foot in the door was I worked at what they call the Bevo, which is the bottling plant at the Anheuser-Busch flagship headquarters in St. Louis. And I did a co-op there.
Oh, that'd be awesome. That's like a live-in tour all the time.
It was so cool. And my favorite story about that was that while I was working there, somebody messed up and left a door open. And the Bevo is like in the basement of a building. So you have to like drive down a ramp to get in. And one day I came into work and the bottle lines were shut down. And it was like, oh, the drama of like what happened. This drunk guy had driven down and somebody left the door open and he was driving around the bottle lines in his car. He was so drunk, he didn't know where he was.
That's dangerous. He'd run that car into a, you know, multi-million dollar bottling piece of equipment. That'd be a disaster.
I don't believe that he damaged any equipment. He was too drunk to know where he was, but not too drunk to navigate.
All right. Well, hopefully there was good lighting and maybe he followed the yellow stripes along the lanes. And oh, I can imagine the plant, you know, the ops guys just going crazy. How'd that happen? That's great.
I don't know, but I thought it was really funny.
Oh, it is. Yeah. So is that one of the skills you need as a junior reliability engineer, is how to move a car off the assembly line, off the line?
I don't think so, but I do know you have to have a sense of humor.
Yeah. I don't know. So what, I mean, that's a way cool spot. Did they have I imagine they had a reasonable reliability program and was that where the co-op was with the reliability group or team?
They, you know, really, my co-op at that time was not with the reliability group. I'm sure they had reliability in-house, but I don't know what it consisted of. At that time, it was bottle line maintenance and design. Okay. So I worked with a couple of bottle line engineers who taught me about installing new bottle lines, doing maintenance. And one person that I remember in particular was a mechanic named Joe, and that was probably close to 20 years ago, and I still think of him fondly. Mm-hmm. So if Joe's out there, hi, I really enjoyed working with you. You taught me a lot, especially about interpersonal skills, but
well, that's something you don't, I mean, you mentioned that in our other episode, is that the soft skills part was a challenge right off the bat for you, and so it sounded like you had a good start, at least a couple of good examples, if nothing else, to get you going on that. But they don't teach that in school. I went to school and I had physics and electrical engineering from some of the most dull, non-energetic, non-personality type people. And if they're listening, you know, hopefully you're not teaching anywhere. but you know, right? You mentioned that last time, yeah. And here you're at it again. It's not what you learned in college. Was that what you thought was missing from college? Why you didn't want to sit in the classrooms or?
No, I just, I'm one of those people that like was raised a very sheltered life. My parents, they really loved me so much that they were afraid to let me go and do things. And their fear kind of affected me pretty profoundly. You know, a lot of kids in high school are like going out and, you know, doing new things, like, you know, maybe they try a beer or whatever at a party. I never, ever went to a party in high school. I went to school. I was a national level athlete rower. And that's all I did. And first robotics, which is kind of what got me into engineering
stuff. Yeah, that's cool.
And I graduated high school and went to college when I was 17, so I was a little bit young. And I really, really struggled in college because I couldn't find a way to fit in. I was very awkward. And I didn't really know it either. Like, You know, I wouldn't say I was like Sheldon Cooper, but maybe a little bit like his girlfriend. I don't know.
But it, you know, it's in school, it's tough. I mean, I was on the geek side of the world, and it's still awkward, and there's still stuff you don't know, and you can pretend you know, but you, it's there's this imposter syndrome. The more you know, the more you realize you don't know. I think there's parts to that. I wouldn't worry
but
about that.
But there's like
too
some
much.
People that just have it, Fred. You know, like they've got that, like they're relaxed with other people, and yeah. They get along really well, and it just comes easily for them. And then there's people like me that like have to engineer it to think about it, because otherwise we're going to say something dumb.
Okay. Yeah. No, there was a classmate of mine in college. He was desperate one day to drum up some money. He was trying to learn how the stock market worked on his own. Wasn't part of any class or anything we were doing, and he was using real money, and he did some puts and calls, which were kind of like bets on the market, or they're I think they're actually insurance contracts, so that if say IBM is $100 a share and it goes to 120, and that's not what the person wanted, there's an insurance contract, and then whoever there's terms to it and payment, whatever. But one didn't work out. And he had to pay it, and he needed like $80,000 real fast. And so he's borrowing money from everybody to make that happen. But nobody hesitated to give it to him. The guy was, it wasn't a con artist or anything like that. He was genuine. He was sincere. He was trustworthy, all these great things. He later became a Rhodes Scholar. This guy was academically gifted. And he was, like you said, he had it together. But I've only known one Rhodes Scholar, and everybody else, yeah, whatever. I'm not too
That's
worried
one
about
more
it.
Rhodes Scholar than I know, Fred.
Yeah, it's a Rhodes Scholar. I think he still owes me money, actually.
Well, you better get that money from him.
I know. Yeah.
I bet he's rich by now.
He probably is. But it is, it's pretty cool, you know, and I agree. There are different ranges of people that have different it's not just introvert, extrovert. It's like you said, it's being comfortable with other people and what to say and when and all those kinds of things. It's another thing that I think is the socialization part of high school and college that teaches you that stuff. But it plays in our reliability work all the time, because we have to influence other people to get things done. It means you got to talk to them. Did you notice that in that you're various co-ops and situations?
I think you're overestimating my social skills as a co-op and intern.
Okay.
Anybody who knows me and is listening to this that worked with me in my first 2 or 3 years, maybe even 5 years, will probably laugh. I'm very fortunate that I had some excellent people that could coach me on interpersonal skills. And without them, I think I would have been that person who moved from job to job because they were losing their job instead of because they were making a choice to do it.
Right. Well, it underscores how important it is. I know Ash Norton in her column writes about engineering leadership, which I think is a really great title to get into a lot of the soft skills. And I know I've been writing more about it too, because it's not taught in college, and I don't think it's, some people have it, some don't. I think you can learn it. And I think you're seeing that you can learn it.
I think some of the challenge of the internet is the feeling that you get when you read about what everybody else is doing, and you're like, well, what am I doing with my life? All I do is like feed babies and go to sleep every night.
Well, you also keep this factory running in West Virginia too. So I think you've got more to your day than that.
The factory running, but it's interesting because I like talking to Ash. I've talked to her once or twice over LinkedIn.
Okay.
For me, she's kind of like a couple steps ahead of me of like maybe the path that I might want to go on, which is, you know, she has, you know, children, and she's sort of living the dream of being able to have a flexible work schedule because she works for herself.
Right.
And I'm not sure if that's where I want to go, but I really like her business because she gives a good service of coaching, you know, young engineers and people that want to go into leadership and offering them good advice. I don't know if my advice is good, but I'm pretty sure hers is.
You know, and it comes with experience. Unfortunately, there are, I mean, you can read Harvard Business Review all day long, but I don't think it teaches you how to be a leader in any given situation. And and Ash has had some great experience.
Yeah, I'm an experienced reliability engineer, but I wouldn't say that I'm an experienced leader. I think Ash might be the same age or maybe even a little bit younger than I am.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. But now she's I got to really go back. She's good. But I'm going to challenge you on, you know, if you're a good reliability engineer, I think by default, you have to be a good leader. You have to get other people to do stuff, right? Whether it's the technicians or your maintenance team or the or operators on the floor or management to fund things or to change designs. We generally don't have the authority just to say, do it this way. We provide input and rationale and have to be convincing. And I think that's a leader.
Yeah, I think for sure you have to have a certain level of you have to have a certain level of ability to work with others and influence them in a positive way. Mm-hmm. You can't be like bullheaded and jump in there and be like, I'm Fred Schenkelberg and I'm smarter than you and I've been working longer than you and I'm going to tell you what to do.
Well, I know she didn't use your name on that, so thanks.
Yep. Well, I mean, you know, you're the older bully in this conversation.
Oh, okay. So. I get it.
I'm the helpless millennial.
That's right. I think by default, we are leaders. To be effective as reliability engineers, we have to lead. And I think the nature of leading is not the bully. I don't think that works. And we learn that pretty quick by either by seeing examples that we go, man, that's terrible. I'm not following this path. That vision doesn't make any sense. Or, you know, and then or you get the culture where people just do what they're told and then nothing else. And it's not a fun place to work.
You have to be a good listener, a good negotiator. And I like to think that reliability is the conscience of the plant. Operations advocates for production and maintenance advocates for the equipment, but reliability advocates as the conscience of the plant to say, okay, what is the right thing to do?
That's a good, we'll have to write that down. That's good. So, no, I had never thought of it that way. So you're not talking like you're just a new reliability engineer. That's awesome.
Thanks.
You kind of set me back on my heels here. Wow, I'll have to think about that some more. That's pretty, I like that.
I'm glad that you enjoy my perspective on it. I've put almost a decade into thinking about it, so.
Okay. Well, it's working. No problem. So, now, I'm going to go back. I think we got off track like 3-4 times so far here.
Yeah.
I think my first question to you was kind of a follow-up with that something similar will be asked to all the other co-hosts is, and we all talked about is, well, how did you get into reliability? So you were talking about you had all these – you didn't like the academic part of going to school, so you got all these jobs essentially in co-ops and internships. And you had a couple of good experiences in reliability. Was that – really the genesis that got you into reliability engineering?
So one job in particular, my first real experience with reliability was as a co-op at Nine Mile Nuclear Power Plant in New York. Okay. And I worked there with, I actually got recruited by the site VP, who is a super stand-up guy. He really has, he advocated for me quite a few times, and he had a couple of guys that are consultants working for him that worked at the plant to support basically reliability, but technical support, and they would do root cause and that kind of thing. And they were Tom DeChant and Bud Willoughby. And when I graduated from college or was about to graduate, I called up that site VP whose name is Tim O'Connor. And I said, hi, I don't know if you remember me. And this is the networking part, right?
Right.
But I really enjoyed working for you. And I noticed that you have started a new position in Minnesota. And I would really like to come and work for you again. And he paused for a minute and he said, okay, well, here's a job. I'm starting a new group at this plant that's a maintenance engineering thing, and I'd really like you to come out. And so I went out and interviewed, and I got offered the job. And I think I had the highest graduating salary in my class at school because of that networking opportunity.
Oh, that's amazing.
And it is. And Bud and Tom were, of course, had gone out there, and he had hired them in Minnesota, too. Mm-hmm. And I got to spend, I think, around 2 years working with them. And they were just really good engineers. And I don't think either of them is an engineer by degree, but they are both engineers by experience.
Okay.
Very knowledgeable, excellent with controls. They really knew nuclear power plants and the rules and requirements. And I was very fortunate to have them as mentors. And as part of my role there, I took vibration training. And I have been an ISO Category 3 vibration analyst for almost 10 years because of that role.
Okay.
It's been 8 years. So 2009, I think, is when I first took it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, about 8 years. But that's gets you started in the reliability engineering world, and vibration analyst is a piece of that. Did it just catch your attention and get you started in larger areas of reliability, or has it always been in the vibration, which is not, it's an important job and I'm sure a full career in itself, but.
I remember early on in my time there was a pump that was making a funny sound, and they said, why don't you go out with the vibration analyst, whose name is Don Rota, and go out with him and see what he does to troubleshoot this pump.
Mm-hmm.
And Don goes out and he's got his, I think it was a 2130. I don't know for sure because that was quite some time ago.
Mm-hmm.
But he's out there with his CSI unit and his, you know, his earmuffs, and he's like listening to the machine. And he's got this, you know, he's got this whole setup, and he looks up and he says, I'll be right back. And you could tell that he knew what the problem was, but he wasn't going to tell anybody until he had looked at his data.
Right, right.
And he really knew his stuff, and he impressed me a lot because it was like you've got this like black box going in and this magical instrument, and oh my goodness, what is it? And it's like the wizard knows, right?
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah, I ran into a maintenance manager, Werner, that was like that, but he didn't need any fancy black box. He could just walk down the aisle and he'd turn and he'd look at a piece of equipment, pull out a screwdriver, adjust an alignment on something. He was so good.
Don't know. Someday I will tell you a story about that.
Okay.
People who think they can touch machines and magically know what the problem is. But I will not tell you that story today because it's too close to when that story happened and they'll know who it was.
Okay. I was amazed by, and Werner, he loved the equipment in the plant. I think he just kind of grew up with the plant. But
yeah.
Anyway, he was that kind of guy. Now, it used to be the old style equipment. I remember when I was in the Army, we had the old Jeeps before the Humvees. And to set the timing, you took the distributor cap and rotated it until the engines purred, it was about a fist away from the engine block. But you got it close to that, and then you moved it slightly until it sounded good, and then you locked it down.
Yeah.
That was this process to set the timing on these things. And if you really wanted to do it fancy, you get a strobe light out and measure it that way.
Yeah.
But you could get it pretty darn close just by ear. But there were different times. We didn't have anything on the engine except the engine, as you could actually see it, things like that. Well, anyway, I don't know if I actually got how you got into it. You had some great opportunity out of college.
I just, I fell in love with the idea that you could gather this data and have this like solid idea of, hey, this is what it is, without being able, it was like having an x-ray machine, you know. And the more that I learned about it, the more exciting it was, because you sort of like picture in your head, I love vibration, Fred, this is like my favorite subject, so thanks. But I love to picture in my head, you know, okay, how many veins are there, what are the balls in the bearing, how many times am I seeing this hit in the frequency, you know, how much is the amplitude. I love to picture that. It's just, it's so exciting. And I was thrilled that I got to go, because I not only did my category one, but I got to do my category two, like 2 weeks in a row.
Oh, wow.
And it was fun. It was like this exciting thing. And then I get back to the plant and I get to apply it. And it was really a fun time for me. And then I was able to take that knowledge and apply it at different ways, at different jobs, which I thought was really cool, because I didn't just use it for maintenance reliability. I used it in a couple of jobs where I actually personally set up and spec'd the accelerometer and wrote the MATLAB or the LabVIEW program to pull the data. Like it was super cool. And that has really drawn my whole career together, is I've had lots of different facets of different industries and different ways of doing things. But the thing that has always stayed the same, that has never lied to me, is the vibration data.
Okay. Well, we're going to have to come back with some more episodes to talk about the vibration part, because I know it's a skill, and I know the amount of training that goes into it. But I also imagine there's times when people look at you, go, well, I don't trust your data, you know, or that's, how do you move through that? How do you get people to say, yeah, this is good or not good? Because I think that probably be topics for your articles too.
I would love to do a whole episode just on technical writing, you know, because I have been in a lot of situations as a category three analyst where even experienced rotating equipment engineers have no idea what I'm talking about. And it doesn't help either when you're young looking. I look younger than I am, and I am pretty young, and I'm also female. So it's interesting to be in a situation where you have older men or people that, you know, have a lot more experience than you, and you know that they don't have the right information to make a good decision, and you're trying to give them that information, but they're very resistant because of the source.
Well, there's the source. It's contrary to what they believe. I mean, that's a whole episode. Let's save that for then. So I had a number of other areas I would still want to talk to you about, because one of the notes that we had before we started this episode was what we use from college and what we don't use from college. And I think we touched on some of those things, yet I think there's a bunch more there. We'll have to come back to that, but I want to shift it over to our listeners. Now, Katie, you and I rambled a bit. We went kind of all over the place in a variety of topics. I think some good stories and some interesting stuff. Plus, we set up, I think, is going to be an ongoing discussion. So I'm really looking forward to sitting down with you again and chatting, talking shop, essentially. But for our listeners that are out there, you know, what would you like to ask? What would you like to chime in on? What comments do you have? What stories do you have that we sparked in this episode? Head over to reliability.fm, and you can find a suggestion box and comment fields on the different episodes. And we would love to hear from you. It really makes our day when we hear, especially good comments, but any comments and suggestions and ideas. We're always looking for ways to improve the show. Also, like to know that there's actually people listening. That's always gratifying. So head over to reliability.fm and let us know what you think. And essentially, join us at the table. We'd love to talk to you. And with that, Katie, I think we'll wrap it up for today.
Great.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.